am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. From then-Senator John F. Kennedy, Profiles in Courage. Starting his essay on Senator George Norris, congressman and senator from Nebraska in the early 20th century. At precisely 1 p.m. one wintry afternoon early in 1910, Representative John Dalzell of Pennsylvania left the speaker's chair and walked out of the House chamber for his daily cup of coffee and piece of pie in the Capitol restaurant. His departure was not unusual, for Representative Dalzell, who was Speaker Joe Cannon's first assistant in ruling the House from the speaker's chair, had always left the chamber at exactly that hour, and he was almost invariably succeeded in the chair by Representative Walter Smith of Iowa. But on that particular January afternoon, Representative Dalzell's journey up the aisle was watched with curious satisfaction by a somewhat shaggy-looking representative in a plain black suit and a little shoestring tie. And the assistant speaker had no sooner reached the door of the chamber when Republican Representative George W. Norris of Nebraska walked over to Representative Smith and asked if he might be recognized for 2 minutes. Smith, a member of the Cannon-Dalzell Republican ruling clique, but a personal friend of Norris, agreed. To his astonishment, Representative Norris sought to amend the resolution then under debate, a resolution calling for a joint committee to investigate the Ballinger-Pinchot conservation dispute by requiring the entire House of Representatives to appoint its members to the investigating committee instead of granting the customary authority to the Speaker to make such selections. Page boys scurried out to find Cannon and Dalzell. This was insurrection in the ranks, the first attempt to limit the previously unlimited power of Czar Cannon. But Norris insisted that all he desired was a fair investigation, not one rigged by the administration. Joined by Pinchot's followers, fellow insurgent Republicans, and practically all the Democrats, he succeeded in having his amendment adopted by the narrow margin of 149 to 146. It was the first setback the powerful speaker had ever suffered, and he vowed never to forget it. But for George Norris, the victory on the investigation resolution was only a preliminary step. For in the inner pocket of his threadbare black coat was a scrawled resolution which he had drafted years before, a resolution to have the House, rather than the Speaker, appoint the members of the Rules Committee itself, the committee which completely dictated the House program and was in turn completely dominated by the Speaker. On St. Patrick's Day in 1910, Norris rose to address the Czar. Only minutes before, Speaker Cannon had ruled that a census bill promoted by one of his cohorts was privileged under the Constitution and could be considered out of order, inasmuch as that document provided for the taking of the census. "Mr. Speaker," called Norris, "I present a resolution made privileged by the Constitution." "The government will present it," replied Cannon, smugly unaware of the attack about to be launched. And George Norris unfolded that tattered paper from his coat pocket and asked the clerk to read it aloud. Panic broke out in the Republican leadership. Cloakroom rumors had previously indicated the nature of Norris's proposed resolution, but it was merely a subject of contemptuous amusement among the regular Republicans, who knew they had the power to bury it forever in the Rules Committee itself. Now Speaker Cannon's own ruling on the census bill in support of his friend had given Norris and his resolution, clearly based on the Constitution's provision for House rules, an opening through which the Nebraska congressman led all the insurgent and Democratic forces. Speaker Cannon and his lieutenants were masters of parliamentary maneuvering, and they were not immediately ready to concede. They attempted to adjourn to recess to make a quorum impossible. They continued debate on whether the resolution was privileged while the party faithful hurried back from St. Patrick's Day parades. They kept the House in constant session, hoping to break the less organized revolters. All night long, the insurgents stayed in their seats, unwilling to nap off the floor, for fear that Cannon would suddenly rule in their absence. Finally, all attempts at intimidation and compromise having failed, Speaker Cannon, as expected, ruled the resolution out of order, and Norris promptly appealed the decision. By a vote of 182 to 160, Democrats and insurgent Republicans overruled the Speaker, and by a still larger margin, Norris's resolution, already amended to obtain Democratic support, was adopted. The most ruthless and autocratic Speaker in the history of the House of Representatives thereupon submitted his resignation. But George Norris, who insisted his fight was to end the dictatorial power of the office rather than to punish the individual, voted against its acceptance. Years later, Speaker Cannon was to say to Norris, "Norris, throughout our bitter controversy, I do not recall a single instance in which you have been unfair. I cannot say this of many of your associates, and I want to say to you now that if any member of your damn gang had to be elected to the Senate, I would prefer it be you more than any of them." The overthrow of Cannonism broke the stranglehold which the conservative Republican leaders had held over the government and the nation, and it also ended whatever favors the representative from Nebraska had previously received at their hands. Under the Czar, the office of the Speaker of the House wielded what sometimes appeared to be very nearly equal power with the President and the entire United States Senate. It was a power that placed party above all other considerations, a power that fed on party loyalty, patronage, and political organizations. It was a power which, despite increasingly disfavor in all parts of the country outside the East, had continued unchallenged for years. But one man without position, an editor commented, against 200 welded into the most powerful political machine that Washington has ever known, has twice beaten them at their own game. Mr. George Norris is a man worth knowing and watching. George W. Norris was worth watching. For his subsequent career in the Senate, to which he was elected shortly after his triumph over Speaker Cannon, earned him a reputation as one of the most courageous figures in American political life. The overthrow of Cannonism, although welcomed in Nebraska by all but a few party stalwarts, had nevertheless required tremendous courage and leadership on the part of a young congressman attacking his party's well-entrenched leaders and willing to sacrifice the comforts and alliances that party loyalty brings. In the Senate, Norris frequently broke not only with his party, but with his constituents as well. He once declared, "I would rather go down to my political grave with a clear conscience than ride in the chariot of victory as a congressional stool pigeon, the slave, the servant, or the vassal of any man, whether he be the owner and manager of a legislative menagerie or the ruler of a great nation. I would rather lie in the silent grave, remembered by both friends and enemies, as one who remained true to his faith and who never faltered in what he believed to be his duty, than to still live, old and aged, lacking the confidence of both factions." These are the words of an idealist, an independent, a fighter, a man of deep conviction, fearless courage, sincere honesty, George W. Norris of Nebraska. We should not pretend that he was a faultless paragon of virtue. On the contrary, he was, on more than one occasion, emotional in his deliberations, vitriolic in his denunciations, and prone to engage in bitter and exaggerated personal attack instead of concentrating his fire upon the merits of an issue. But nothing could sway him from what he thought was right, from his determination to help all the people, from his hope to save them from the twin tragedies of poverty and war. George Norris knew well the tragedy of poverty from his own boyhood. His father having died when George was only 4, he was obliged, while still in his teens, to hack out a livelihood for his mother and 10 sisters on the stump-covered farmlands of Ohio. He knew, too, the horrors of war, from the untimely death in the Civil War of the older brother he hardly remembered, but whose inspiring letter, written by the wounded soldier shortly before his death, was treasured by young George Norris for years. In 1917, as the nation teetered on the edge of the European conflict, George Norris had not forgotten his mother's sorrow and her hatred of war. A country teacher, a small-town lawyer, a local prosecuting attorney and judge, Those had been the years when George Norris had come to know the people of Nebraska and the West, when he saw the growing pattern of farm foreclosures, lost homesteads, and farm workers drifting to the city and to unemployment. As the old 19th century became the new 20th, America was changing. Her industries and cities were growing. Her power in the world was increasing. And yet George Norris changed, and would change, very little. His chunky figure was still clothed in the drab black suits, white shirts, and little black shoestring ties he had worn most of his life and would wear until his death. His mild manners, disarming honesty, and avoidance of the social circle of politics in favor of a quiet evening of reading set him apart from the career politicians of his country, whose popularity among the voters, however, he far outstripped. Only his political outlook changed as began the long career, which would keep him in Washington for 40 years. For when George Norris had first entered the House of Representatives in 1903, fresh from the plains of Nebraska, he had been a staunch conservative Republican, sure of my position, as he later wrote, unreasonable in my convictions, and unbending in my opposition to any other political party or political thought except my own. But, one by one, I saw my favorite heroes wither. I discovered that my party was guilty of virtually all the evils that I had charged against the opposition. No single chapter could recount in full all of his courageous and independent battles that he led. His most enduring accomplishments were in the field of public power, and there are few parallels to his long fight to bring the benefits of low-cost electricity to the people of the Tennessee Valley, although they lived 1,000 miles from his home state of Nebraska. But there were three struggles in his life that are worthy of a special note for the courage displayed. The overthrow of Czar Speaker Cannon, already described, his support of Al Smith for president in 1928, and his filibuster against the Armed Ship Bill in 1917. When Woodrow Wilson sorrowfully determined upon a policy of armed neutrality in early 1917, appeared before a tense joint session of Congress to request legislation authorizing him to arm American merchant ships, the American public gave its immediate approval. Unrestricted German submarine warfare was enforcing a tight blockade by which the Kaiser sought to starve the British Isles into submission, and Secretary of State Lansing had been politely informed that every American ship encountered in the war zone would be torpedoed. Already American vessels had been searched, seized, and sunk. Tales of atrocities to our seamen filled the press. As debate on the bill got underway, the newspapers learned of a new plot against the United States, contained in a message from the German Undersecretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Zimmermann, to the German minister in Mexico. The alleged note, for there were those who questioned its authenticity and the motives of the British and American governments in disclosing it at that particular time, proposed a scheme to align Mexico and Japan against the United States. In return for its use as an invasion base, Mexico was promised restoration of her American colonies, seized more than 70 years earlier by Sam Houston and his compatriots. When the contents of the Zimmermann note were leaked to the newspapers, all resistance to the armed ship bill in the House of Representatives instantly collapsed. The bill was rushed through that body by the overwhelming vote of 403-13, a vote which seemed clearly representative of popular opinion in favor of the president's move. Certainly the overwhelming support given the bill by Nebraska's congressmen represented the feelings of that state. But in the Senate on March 2, 1917, the armed ship bill met determined opposition from a small bipartisan band of insurgents led by Robert La Follette of Wisconsin and George Norris of Nebraska. As freshman senator from a state which the previous year had voted for a Democratic legislature, governor, senator, and president, George Norris, unlike La Follette, was neither a solidly established political figure in his own bailiwick, nor confident that his people were opposed to Wilson and his policies. In previous months, Norris had supported the president on major foreign policy issues, including the severing of diplomatic ties with the German government. Although a militant pacifist and isolationist, Norris's very nature prohibited him from being a mere obstructionist on all international issues or a petty partisan opposing all of the president's requests. Indeed, by the time World War II approached, his isolationism had largely vanished. But George Norris hated war, and he feared that big business, which he believed was providing the stimuli for our progress along the road to war, was bent on driving the nation into a useless, bloody struggle, that the president, far from taking the people into his confidence, was trying to stampede public opinion into pressuring the Senate for war, and that the armed ship bill was a device to protect American munition profits with American lives, a device which could push us directly into conflict as a combatant without further deliberation by Congress or actual attack upon the United States by Germany. Norris was fearful of the bill's broad grant of authority, and he was resentful of the manner in which it was being steamrolled through the Congress. It is not now important whether Norris was right or wrong. What is now important is the courage he displayed in support of his convictions. "People may not believe it," Senator Norris once said, "but I don't like to get into fights." In 1917, whether he liked it or not, the freshman from Nebraska prepared for one of the hardest, most embittering struggles of his political career. Since those days were prior to Norris's own 20th or lame duck amendment, the 64th Congress would expire at noon on March 4th when a new presidential term began. Thus, passage of the bill by that Congress could be prevented if the Senate could not vote before that hour. And Norris and his little band were hopeful that the new Congress, chosen by the people during the presidential campaign of 1916, based upon the slogan, "He kept us out of war," might join in opposition to the measure, or at least give it more careful consideration. George Norris, an advocate of change in the Senate rules to correct the abuse of filibustering, but feeling strongly that the issue of war itself was at stake, adopted this very tactic of filibustering in spite of my repugnance to that method. As parliamentary floor leader for his group, he arranged speakers to make certain that there was no possibility of a break in the debate which would enable the bill to come to a vote. Many of his closest friends in the Senate were aghast at this conduct. "No state but one populated by mollycoddles," complained one senator, well aware of the raging anti-German sentiment back home, "would endorse what Norris is trying to do." But Nebraska did not endorse the position of its junior senator. As debate got underway, the Nebraska newspapers, in a thinly veiled warning, reported that the tremendous vote in the House represents the sentiments of the people, and the Nebraska legislature had already unanimously pledged to President Wilson the loyal and undivided support of the entire citizenry of the state of Nebraska, of whatever political party and of whatever blood or place of birth, in whatever may be found necessary to maintain the right of Americans, the dignity of our nation, and the honor of our flag. But George Norris's guide was his own conscience. "Otherwise," he said, "a member of Congress giving weight to expressed public sentiment becomes only an automatic machine, and Congress requires no patriotism, no education, and no courage." And so, with only his conscience to sustain him, Senator Norris worked around the clock to bolster the sagging spirits of his little band, to prepare new speakers for continuous debate, and to check every opposition moved to end the filibuster. Several senators, Norris later related, privately approached him to wish the filibuster success, while pleading party regularity and political expediency as their grounds for publicly supporting the president's position. When Norris told them that the important thing was to make certain there were plenty of speakers, regardless of the views expressed, two of the president's supporters, by private agreement with Norris, spoke at length in favor of the bill. Day and night, the debate continued, and on the morning of March 4th, the Senate was a scene of weary disorder. "Those final minutes," Norris later wrote, "live in my memory," writing, In that chamber, men became slaves to emotion. The clash of anger and bitterness, in my judgment, never has been exceeded in the history of the United States. When the hour hand pointed to the arrival of noon, the chairman announced adjournment. The filibuster had won. The conference report, which would have authorized the arming of American ships, had failed a Senate approval. Tense excitement prevailed throughout the entire country, and especially in the Senate itself. I have felt from that day to this the filibuster was justified. I never have apologized for the part I took in it. We honestly believed that by our actions in that struggle, we had averted American participation in the war. But theirs was a fleeting victory. For the president, in addition to immediately calling a special session of Congress, in which the Senate adopted a closure rule to limit debate, with Norris's support, also announced that a further examination of the statutes had revealed that the executive power already included the right to arm ships without congressional action. And the president also let loose a blast, still frequently quoted today, against a little group of willful men, representing no opinion but their own, that rendered the great government of the United States helpless and contemptible. George Norris called the president's scathing indictment a grave injustice to men who conscientiously tried to do their duty as they saw it. But, except for the unfortunate and unhelpful praise bestowed upon them by the German press, the epithets heaped upon these men were without precedent in the annals of American journalism. They had earned, in the words of the Louisville Courier Journal newspaper, an eternity of execration. A mass meeting at Carnegie Hall condemned Norris and his colleagues as treasonable and reprehensible men who refused to defend the Stars and Stripes on the high seas, and the crowd hooted "traitor" and "hang him" whenever the names of Norris, La Follette, and their supporters were mentioned. "The time has come," the mayor of New York shouted to another meeting, "when the people of this country are to be divided into two classes, Americans and traitors." The Hartford Courant newspaper called them political tramps, and the New York Sun labeled 12 United States senators a group of moral perverts. The Providence Journal newspaper called their action little short of treason, and the New York Times editorialized that "the odium of treasonable purpose will rest upon their names forever." The New York Herald newspaper predicted they will be fortunate if their names do not go down into history, bracketed with that of Benedict Arnold. In the decades to follow, Senator Norris would learn to withstand the merciless abuse inevitably heaped upon one of his independent and outspoken views. On the Senate floor itself, he would be called a Bolshevik, an enemy of advancement, a traitor, and much more. But now the harsh terms of vilification and the desertion of former friends hurt him deeply. One afternoon, several passengers left a Washington trolley car when Norris and La Follette took seats beside them. His mail was abusive, several letters containing sketches showing him in German uniform complete with medals. The Nebraska press joined in the denunciation of its junior senator. "Can Senator Norris believe," cried the Omaha World Herald, which had listed on page one the names of 12 senators who halt action in greatest crisis since Civil War, "can any man in his senses believe that the American government could tamely submit to these outrages?" The Norris fear of the establishment of an absolute monarchy under Wilson is grotesque, said the Lincoln Star. "Maybe it is a joke. If not, friends of Mr. Norris should look after his mental status." And the Omaha Bee newspaper thought his fear of presidential authority reflects little credit on the senator's common sense. It was believed in Washington that the conscience of the freshman from Nebraska had led him, in the words of one Washington correspondent, to his political death. The outraged Nebraska state legislature, with whooping enthusiasm, passed a resolution expressing the confidence of the state in President Wilson and his policies. George Norris was saddened by the near unanimity which, with my own people, condemned me and asserted that I was misrepresenting my state. and although popularity was not his standard, Norris had tried, he later wrote, throughout his career, to do what in my own heart I believed to be right for the people at large. Thus, unwilling to represent the people of Nebraska if they did not want me, he came to a dramatic decision. He would offer to resign from the Senate and submit to a special recall election to let my constituents decide whether I was representing them or misrepresenting them in Washington. In letters to the governor and the Republican state chairman, he urged a special election, agreeing to abide by the result and to waive whatever constitutional rights protected him from recall. Sharing the fears of his astonished friends in the Senate that hysteria and well-financed opposition might ensure his defeat, which in turn would be interpreted as a mandate for war, Norris nevertheless insisted in his letter to the governor that he had no desire to represent the people of Nebraska if my official conduct is contrary to their wishes. Senator Norris, announcing an open meeting in Lincoln to explain his position, was largely ignored by the press as he journeyed homeward. Attempting to get the Republican National Committee man to act as chairman of the meeting, he was warned by that worthy gentleman that it was not possible for this meeting to be held without trouble. "I think the meeting will be broken up, or at least you will have such an unfriendly audience that it will be impossible for you to make any coherent speech." One of the few friends who called upon him urged him to cancel the meeting by pleading illness, telling Norris that he had made a very sad mistake in returning to Nebraska when feelings ran so high. Others predicted that agitators would be scattered throughout the audience to make presentation of his arguments impossible, and told the senator that torpedoing of three more American merchant ships since the filibuster had further intensified the anger of his constituents. "I cannot remember a day in my life," the senator wrote in his autobiography, "when I have suffered more from a lonely feeling of despondency. My friends led me to believe that the people of Nebraska were almost unanimously against me." John F. Kennedy's essay on Senator George Norris of Nebraska will be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona,